This is SciDoor, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. I'm Tony Cohn. SciDoor producer Rachel Aronoff, welcome to the microphone.
SciDoor host Tony Cohn, thanks so much for having me.
Okay. So what do you have for me?
I have an idea. But before I tell you my idea, I also have a question for you.
Okay.
So in two words, one with a hyphen in it, can you tell me what this episode we're doing is about?
What this episode's about?
This one.
Is
that enough of a clue for you?
It is enough of a clue. Scimitar horned oryx.
You got it. You are playing right into my hands. Okay, second question. Do you think you knew what a scimitar horned oryx was before we started research for this story?
No.
Me neither, right? It's like I grew up with some weird animals in my household, a chinchilla, a parrot. We did not own a scimitar horned oryx,
It wasn't in the Beanie Baby collection.
It wasn't in the Beanie Baby collection. So this brings me to my idea. You ready?
I'm ready.
What if we go around the office, we pull people into our studio, and we ask them to play a little word association game with us?
Not pin the tail on the oryx.
Not pin the tail. That'll be
I
part
think
two.
That sounds like an amazing idea. I think we should go do that. Okay, so we're going to play a game where I'm going to list some animals, and I want you to describe them for me, say the first words that pop into your head.
Great. I don't really like animals, so you're probably not going to use me.
Well, we're off to a good start. Monkey.
Furry.
Long arm, swing from trees.
Brown and soft and very cute.
Tiger.
Tiger, massive claws.
Gorgeous with stripes.
Stripes, orange, black.
A little bit of white, and lots of teeth.
Scimitar horned oryx.
What did you just call me?
A scimitar horned oryx.
Is it like half horse? No. That's a centaur.
Yes. What was that again?
Scimitar horned oryx.
What?
What do you think it is?
A bird? I don't know. Like knee height?
Next. You got me on that one.
So clearly we're not alone. A lot of people don't know what a scimitar horned oryx is.
And I think rightfully so. I mean, they're an extremely rare desert antelope from this remote part of Africa.
And for the record, there are a few different species of oryx. But in this story, we're only talking about the scimitar horned oryx. Most people also probably don't know that about 30 years ago, the scimitar-horned oryx went extinct in the wild. As in, they were all gone from their natural habitat. None left. No wild oryx eating, no wild oryx pooping, no wild oryx making more baby wild oryx.
And for all the talk you hear about de-extinction, bringing back an animal using DNA and that type of thing that we saw in Jurassic Park, that doesn't really exist yet, even though people think it does.
But in some very special cases, there is a way to bring animals back once they've gone extinct in the wild. It's the option of last resort, and it only works if all of the proper ingredients are there. And for this oryx, that might just be the case. So, after a quick break, we're going to look at what happens when scientists decide to try to turn back the clock on extinction and bring a species back decades after the last wild one died. Stay tuned. Welcome back. So, scimitar horned oryx. It doesn't exactly conjure an image in the same way that an elephant or a monkey does. So, we're here visiting the Smithsonian's National Zoo, where there's two of them standing here behind me. They have white bodies, brown necks, and white faces. They're about 3.5 feet tall. They look a bit like an antelope or a deer, but not the running and jumping kind of antelope you might picture galloping away from cheetahs. Oryx have short legs, and they're built a bit like a barrel.
They weigh roughly 200 to 400 pounds, so somewhere in the range of 1 to 2 times the size of an adult human. They wouldn't be as large as a North American elk, but they would be larger than our white-tailed deer, for instance.
This is Jared Staubach. He's a research ecologist at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. And Jared says that the oryx's most defining characteristic is its horns. They're named after the scimitar, a curved type of Arabian sword.
And they certainly know what to do with these horns. At least the folklore is that they are a lion killer. Historically, if they were attacked by a lion, they would lower their head and more or less swipe their head from either left to right or right to left. And that has the effect of, essentially, could slice a lion in half at the belly.
I'm like, where was that in The Lion King?
Yeah, that didn't quite make it in.
Where they live in the Sahel, which is the really dry grassland that sits on the fringes of North Africa's Sahara Desert, oryx manage to eke out a living on the thinnest margins. It doesn't rain often in the Sahel.
Dry to the point that the amount of water can be measured in tablespoons. So, you know, 9 months of the year, it essentially doesn't rain. And then there's generally a pulse of rain right around July or August.
The oryx solution? They kind of just don't drink very often or sweat.
And instead, they somehow can allow their internal body temperature to fluctuate, potentially as high as 115 or 116 degrees. Somehow they're able to still keep their organs and their brain cool, but they allow their extremities basically to fluctuate, which, you know, they're tough. They can just deal with a lot of adversity.
It's like they were always walking a tightrope of survival, but they were really good tightrope walkers. That is, until the 20th century, when they ran into something that evolution left them totally unprepared for. People. Lots of us. To give you perspective, N'Djamena, the capital city of Chad, one of the countries that historically was home to the oryx, in 1937, it had a population of fewer than 10,000 people. As of 2012, it had over 1 million people. That's an increase of more than 10,000%. And that's been happening all over Central Africa.
Humans are able to access areas that 100 years ago, we were unable to do so, right? You wouldn't find people that were living in the desert.
But more people also means more livestock. And the livestock directly compete with oryx for their meager resources.
And so those people are competing for the same habitat that the animals are also looking to exploit. I think that the thing you have to remember is that the margins for survival in this landscape are very small. And so there certainly are tipping points.
So the first tipping point, as you've heard, is people and their livestock. And then there's the environmental changes. Because of climate change, the Sahara Desert has grown outward, swallowing the hot, dry grasslands that fed the oryx.
Which led to a decrease in the amount of habitat.
But ultimately, the story of the oryx's downfall is a human story.
The main thing and the real piece that led to their sharp decline and eventual extinction was really civil unrest across the region.
During the 1960s and 70s in Chad, there was a brutal 15-year civil war. In bloody human conflicts, animals are often collateral damage. There were outside groups that came in with trucks and big weapons, hunting oryx in a way that was neither traditional nor sustainable. And the local people had other concerns. The disappearing oryx weren't really on their radar.
Even if you lived in the environment where these animals were, you wouldn't necessarily see them on a daily basis, right? So you'd see them maybe during the wet season. But then the animals would move away because they needed to find resources. And it's kind of, it's a different perspective, right? If you're on the ground, your view of the world is quite limited. For instance, someone on the ground would just say, oh, we haven't seen them in a few years, but then they might return. And so it's kind of hard to convince someone that this animal is extinct when they're used to not seeing them for long periods at a time.
So between the changing climate and people having problems concerning their own survival, the oryx just kind of slipped away.
Yeah, so in the 1980s is when the last known oryx was seen in the wild.
For most animals, that's where the story ends. There isn't a backup that lets us reboot species that aren't alive anymore. Some can still be found in zoos and other places, but even then, it's like they're floating in a type of purgatory. They're not fully extinct, you can still see them, but they also don't really exist. Not in the wild. And it's not just the animals that are impacted. When a species goes extinct, the environment changes. Sometimes other animals take their place in the ecosystem, but most of the time, That gap is filled by humans. Fences go up, roads slice through the solitude, the whole area becomes tamer. But fortunately, there are exceptions. Coming up next, we'll hear about the faintest glimmer of hope that a handful of scientists saw and said, okay, it's a long shot, but we think we can bring the Oryx back home. So stick around. Welcome back. We've been hearing about the trials and tribulations of the scimitar-horned oryx, a burly kind of desert antelope with these beautiful curved long sharp horns. They lived on the smallest margins in the very dry grasslands of Central Africa, just south of the Sahara Desert. And not so long ago, sometime in the early 1980s, the last wild oryx died. But they weren't gone. The oryx still had a living population in captivity. One of the places that the oryx rode out extinction in the wild was the Smithsonian Institution.
Antelopes rock for me, and for there are a lot of people like me that really like things with hooves.
That's Steve Mumford.
I'm the director of the National Zoological Park and Conservation Biology Institute.
Steve has been working with the scimitar-horned oryx for decades. He's studied them extensively and is one of the world's leading experts on the animal. And at the National Zoo, Steve's office is just a couple hundred feet from where they live.
Well, honestly, they're not very hard to keep in captivity. They're just like a big, you know, like a cow with horns. If you give them grass and water, they prefer water if they can get it. They don't actually need it, which is one of the interesting biological facts about them. But they do very well in human care.
Which is a good thing.
So zoos have a very strong role to play in being basically the Fort Knox of the genomics or the genetics of species. And those one day will become increasingly important as the threats to species intensify over time.
Perhaps the biggest break for the oryx happened through complete serendipity. So one day about 20 years ago, Steve was in his office working on some antelope research, minding his own business.
I got a call one day, literally a random call back in the day when people just called on the telephone, and I picked it up and this guy said, my name is Khalid and I work for the Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi.
The voice on the phone was talking about Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan, one of the founders of the United Arab Emirates.
And we would like to get your help in having to learn how to increase reproduction in a species of Arabian tar, a small little goat-like antelope.
And Steve did the logical thing. When you receive a royal invitation to visit a country, you go.
And I was invited over to visit Abu Dhabi and just to give them some advice and consultation. I took a team of other antelope experts with me and they paid for our travel and so forth. So on one of the daily excursions, they wanted to take us to an island in the Arabian Gulf that was Sheikh Zayed's private island, and he had a palace there. The island was it had 50,000 animals on this island. We were being driven around like a tourist on a private to see the Sheikh's private collection. And as we turned one corner, we saw this white-ish looking antelope off in the distance, and we asked the driver if he could take us over there, and this is in a mini bus. And as we got over there, we were astounded. This was some of the world's preeminent antelope experts to see 1,500 scimitar-horned oryx in one massive enclosure being fed giant bales of alfalfa hay.
Think about that. This is the mother load. Steve was making a trip to help Abu Dhabi with their cute little mountain antelope, but then he practically tripped across thousands of scimitar-horned oryx, an animal that was completely extinct in the wild. Steve was floored.
And our jaws just dropped, and we said, oh my God, you know, look at that. That at that time doubled the known world population of scimitar-horned oryx in one instant, at least to us.
Before this, they knew that there were some scimitar-horned oryx in captivity, but all of a sudden, there were way more of them than anyone would ever have guessed.
Turns out there were, you know, once we started looking, we realized there were maybe as many as 10,000 of these in human care, even though they were extinct in the wild since the mid-1980s.
And that happy accident gave Steve and a group of fellow antelope researchers an idea. Maybe we can get some of these scimitar-horned oryx back where they belong.
But the dream of, you know, everyone's dream working in zoos and in conservation is not to manage animals only in captivity. It's to restore the species to the wild, if possible. But how do we do that? That's the challenge.
So Steve and his team sat down to try to figure it out. Steve Mumford says that once the decision to try to release the scimitar-horned oryx had been made, it took about 3 years of meetings and a lot of bureaucratic wrangling to create a plan. One thing that they needed to decide, where would they put these free-roaming scimitar-horned oryx? Melissa Songer is a biologist at the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute, and she studies how scimitar-horned oryx and other animals move and interact on a landscape. And she says location selection is very important.
Well, first of all, you have to have a place to put them in. And that can be sometimes the most difficult thing, because when a species becomes endangered or even disappears from the wild and becomes extinct in the wild, there are many reasons why.
Since Chad had been the scimitar-horned oryx's last stronghold in the wild and was in a pretty stable period, Team Oryx figured it'd be a good spot for the reintroduction.
So what you need to do is address those threats in the place where they're being returned, to the point where you feel confident that you have a reasonable chance of getting the species back there, even though it's a place where it did disappear. So finding that place, we were very fortunate with the oryx because we had access to a game reserve, 80,000 square kilometer area in central Chad, the place they were last seen in the wild. So theoretically, one of the best places for them to continue to survive.
In case you missed that, the chunk of land they're looking at is 80,000 square kilometers, which is about the size of South Carolina. Once Team Scimitar-Horned Oryx knew where they wanted to put them, they had to get the right combination of oryx in the same place. And it turns out that herd in Abu Dhabi was a pretty perfect place to start. Since the visit that National Zoo Director Steve Mumford made to Abu Dhabi back in the early 2000s, their herd had ballooned to about 3,000 oryx. But the Emiratis didn't have much information about the original herd, how many there were, or how related all of them might have been.
Honestly, we just don't know. We think that it was a handful. You know, I'm sure that it wasn't a huge number.
That's Justin Chuvin, who works on the Oryx Reintroduction Program with the Environment Agency Abu Dhabi. Not knowing the number of oryx doesn't sound like a big deal. But the problem is that the researchers didn't really want to put in all of this time and spend all kinds of money creating a new wild population if they're all siblings and first cousins. Very much like humans, that's a bad recipe for long-term success. So, to account for this, they did extensive genetic tests on the oryx in Abu Dhabi.
So the idea there was to increase the genetic diversity of the animals that we were going to reintroduce into the wild.
Then they went on a global oryx talent search, carefully selecting oryx with genetics that would complement the world herd in Abu Dhabi.
We had, obviously, our original animals in the UAE that had originally come from Chad, and then we sourced animals from all across the U.S. and all over Europe as well.
So at this point, a huge chunk of land was picked in Chad, and the oryx crew knew that the herd was diverse enough to thrive for generations without things getting weird. But the next question, how on earth is this group of oryx going to get from the United Arab Emirates 2,000 miles across Saudi Arabia, the Red Sea, Sudan, and into Chad? The answer, of course, is to fly.
If I can just back up for 1 second, if you don't mind, I'll just tell you the little journey. We start first thing in the morning, actually usually before the sun even comes up, and we get the animals loaded into the crates very quickly, get them loaded onto the truck, drive to the airport, and that takes about an hour. So as soon as we can get the animals through the customs and onto the plane in their individual crates. And so these planes are old Russian cargo planes called Ilyushin IL-76s. So it's one of those that the door opens in the back and it's a big ramp. And so all the animals get loaded from the back.
Then the plane closed its doors. The scimitar-horned oryx put their seats back and tray tables in the upright and locked position, and they were ready for takeoff. For Steve Mumford, who joined the oryx on the flight from the United Arab Emirates all the way to Chad, that's when things got real.
I think that is the moment that I knew it was really happening. We were taking off, but it was just surreal. We're flying to Chad in the middle of nowhere, and this Ukrainian, you know, navigator is offering us shots of vodka in the back of the cargo plane. But when we landed and we unloaded these animals and we put them on trucks, we drove for 10 hours.
After 18 years of thinking about and planning for this moment, Steve Mumford and the Scimitar Horned Oryx were on the ground in the Sahel after being gone for decades. It was an emotional journey for Steve as much as a physical one for the Oryx.
Very carefully, the animals were with a crane, were offloaded and lined up in a row. I think there were about 10 crates lined up side by side. And then a number of us were invited to climb up on top of the crates, and then they had a hatch door. And so somebody counted down and we lifted up the door simultaneously, and then they all went running out.
The crates that the scimitar horned oryx were transported in, they look a bit like huge vertical shoeboxes with air holes. The person who's releasing the oryx stands on top and slides a trapdoor up and out of the oryx's way.
As soon as I saw the animal running out and they, in unison, were all immediately coming together like into a herd and running full steam up a rise, that was when I was able to visually take it all in. And I was just joy, you know. And I know I'm a pretty emotional person anyway, but I was crying, but I didn't know I was crying at the time, but I could just feel the tears streaming down my face. And I thought, well, this is just absolute joy. I mean, that the definition of working your whole career and dreaming of doing something like that in that one condensed moment of having that happen is just exceptional.
The Oryx lived in these 50-acre holding pens for a few months. In this time, Melissa Songer, the Smithsonian biologist we met earlier, and her team monitored the Oryx to make sure that they were transitioning well from being captive animals to wild ones. Veterinarians watched them, and every one of the scimitar-horned Oryx were fitted with tracking collars.
So putting satellite collars on all the animals, tracking them, and being able to use that data to understand what they're going to need and how they're moving. We can learn a lot about their ecology. So having that expertise, first of all, with satellite tracking, but also in spatial analysis and data management and all those pieces are really important. Of course, veterinary care for the captive animals and also in the acclimatization period is critical.
On August 16th, 2016, 21 scimitar-horned oryx were released from their holding pens into Chad's Wadi Rumeh, Wadi Hashim Faunal Reserve. I'm trying to understand, you have all these oryxes that are living in Chad and then they go extinct, and then we bring them back into the wild. How do we make sure that they don't go extinct again?
Well, we need to understand why they went extinct. What we need to do is address those threats in the place where they're being returned. And so that really is tied in with the working with the local communities, getting their thoughts on it, getting their input, making them a part of the process is really critical. Because even with 90 out there, if hunters or if outside people would come in and try to get the oryx, because they actually are worth a lot of money, the horns are, it really wouldn't take long to wipe them out again.
It's like 10,000 different ingredients.
Yeah. I like to say it takes a village to save a species.
Since August 2016, there have been two more releases. In all, 72 scimitar-horned oryx were reintroduced. And they seem to have taken to their new but very old home. 57 baby oryx have been born in Chad, bringing their total number to 111. And now, there's another release planned of 74 oryx for summer 2018. But that's not the end of the journey for the oryx. In a way, it's just the beginning. Time will tell if these tough antelope can thrive, walking that tightrope between a desert that's creeping into their ecosystem and a booming human population. The odds for the scimitar-horned oryx are still long, but they have a dedicated team of people watching out for them. And fortunately, they're great tightrope walkers. You've been listening to Side Door, a podcast from the Smithsonian with support from PRX. If you want to see the video of the oryx being released, check it out on our website, which is si.edu/sidedoor. Want to learn more about the amazing work being done by the National Zoo and the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute? Check out hashtag We Save Species on Twitter, where you'll find Smithsonian scientists tackling some of today's most complex conservation challenges. And while you're at it, check out our tweets by following us at SciDoorPod. And we wanted to give a special extra thank you and good luck to our musical wizard and friend, Nico Picaro. He won't be far. He's moving on to another amazing Smithsonian gig, but we'll always leave a light on for him here at SciDoor. Our podcast team is Justin O'Neill, Rachel Aronoff, Jason Orfanin, Jess Sadek, Greg Fisk, and Elizabeth Pilger. Our show is mixed by Tarek Fuda. Our theme song and other episode music are by Breakmaster Cylinder. We're also supported in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science, technology, and economic performance. More information at sloan.org. Extra support comes from John Barth and Genevieve Sponsler. I'm your host, Tony Cohn. Thanks for listening.
Every time I check my email, every day I'm getting emails from elephants and oryx and horses. So,
are they good typers?
From PRX.